Mini-episode 499 of the FDH Lounge is brought to you by Sportsology, delivering unconventional columns and webcasts about sports, TV, music, movies, and more. Follow them on the web at sportsology.info.
The FDH Lounge. You want to schedule your life around it.
A long time ago, on a gloomy, wet Cleveland spring night, two men stand alone amidst the late night drizzle. Their voices echo across the vacant station parking lot as they debate the merits of the great American radio show that have been missing for far too long. On that night, an idea was born. That idea became the FDH Lounge. Welcome to the FDH Lounge.
Welcome to the FDH Lounge Eyewitness to History Archives. This is FDH Managing Partner Rick Morris. As a part of our 8th anniversary celebration and 500th mini-episode, we have chosen clips from our guests who either helped shape modern history or closely covered major developments. Enjoy the insights as the big stories get told from up close.
It's very surreal to see the state that I live in atop all of the international news headlines yesterday. Everybody's talking about some whack job from Ohio who has caused this to happen and what a terrible tragedy it was. And for when you see somebody like Jack Hanna, who very much like yourself is associated in the public mind with the well-being of animals, as emotional as he was about this yesterday, it was just very striking to see and very, very painful to see somebody who's devoted his life to the welfare of animals down there on the scene. I mean, this was a very, very vivid thing for anybody who loves animals.
Well, animal rights activists all over the country have been trying to get the attention of the federal government and the state governments about this animal collection. The people, they think, oh, this cute little lion cub, I've just got to have it. And then that lion becomes a 250, 300-pound lion, and they don't feed them properly. Most of these collectors, the animals are kept in terrible conditions. They're housed in tiny enclosures, have nothing resembling the life that nature intended for them. They're not fed properly in many cases, and in many cases they're ill and not getting proper medical attention. In fact, Pat Derby told me that up there at the sanctuary that some of the saddest, most pitiful situations that they have, animals that have been brought in, have come from these collectors.
To somebody like me that would say, gee, it would be a great thing. Maybe you have, you know, your semifinal bowls on New Year's Day. You already have the infrastructure in place with the extra game, and it's more or less a week later, so you already have that. That would have been the stumbling block previously. You're not extending the season by doing that. I understand that's not something you're presently an advocate of, but just give me any of your thoughts on the subject, you know, as you've been outlining them over time.
Yeah, I'm not an advocate of it. On the other hand, I'm absolutely willing to listen to what people think about it. Here's the issue. What if Oregon, Auburn, and TCU are still undefeated after the bowl games? Then who picks? Who decides which two move on? And have you really gained anything from what we have right now? I'm not sure about that. The team number three is really going to be unhappy that they didn't get picked. And the other thing about it is a logistical thing, and I think it's really important, and it's that say you're able to play all the bowl games on January 1, which is problematic, mm-hmm. but say you're able to do it, and the championship game a week later, you're not given much time for folks to fans to buy their airline tickets, make hotel arrangements. And at some point would fans say, you know what, I don't think I'll go to the bowl game. I think I'll wait to see if we get in the championship game. Coaches don't have much time to prepare. There's a lot of logistical things that really have to be thought through. And I think the other part of it is, for me, well, we call it bracket creep, C-R-E-E-P, bracket creep. And what it is every – this would not stay at a four-team tournament. Eventually, Team 3 would be so unhappy that they would ask for change, and so this little plus one would turn into an 8-team playoff and then 12 and 16 maybe. And the reason I'm saying that is, if you think about it, every sports bracket has increased through the years. College basketball certainly has. College baseball, softball, the NFL, NBA, every sport, literally every sports bracket has increased. And I think we'd be fooling ourselves if we thought that if we went to a plus one, that we could keep it at that size forever.
Myself and my mom were big fans of Sam Cooke also, and I understand that's something you got from your mom. And I understand that Sam Cooke was a great influence on your voice and how you went ahead with your career and how you approached singing.
So true. I remember being in my mother's Thunderbird, a little tiny Thunderbird that she owned, and we were driving around, and I just remember hearing this song coming off the dashboard, because back then radios had one speaker and they were in the center of the dash. And I just remember hearing this voice come across, and it was it was Sam Cooke, and he was singing Cupid, and the way he sang "Draw Back Your Bow," I just couldn't believe this guy. It's just tunnel vision kicked in on that speaker, and the whole world went away, and I was captivated in the echo, in his voice, in the music, in the track behind his voice, and the way the track sounded, and then the way the track felt, that, you know, the rhythms of it, and the soul this man had in his voice just absolutely slayed me, and I was motivated, highly motivated at that point to find out, be it ever so tiny, what part of that I could ever feel or try to become, to try to experience any of it if I could. And so he truly pushed me and challenged me to reach for some emotion and soul that I wanted in my voice.
You look at a situation here, certainly one would think that if you guys were to win the World Series, your best bet would be probably a scenario like 2003. You had a guy like Josh Beckett who stepped up for the Florida Marlins, and when you look at Clayton Kershaw, who is definitely going to be one of the greatest pitchers of the next decade if he stays healthy, this, the same kind of opportunity I think exists for you guys with him.
Well, that's very true, and we realize that, you know, this guy's got great stuff, and we're relying on him now for the big ones. See, Joe just took him away all season the right way, make sure he didn't hurt himself, and now he's ready to put him in one of the biggest games of his life.
It's not like he was hospitalized back during the medieval ages here. As far as I can remember, it was like still back in February when he was hospitalized. So he's claiming to be sober now, and then yet on the other hand, oh yeah, a couple weeks ago, booze and blow and everything. I mean, does he reconcile in his own head the whole thing of I'm sober, but practically yesterday I was doing blow and booze and everything? I mean, how does he reconcile that?
Yeah, I mean, I think what it is to him now is just a good story, or maybe even to some of us, a bad story. Like, in other words, this is something that happened in his past, even though it was a few days ago. You know, this isn't months ago, like he said. But in his head, he's saying, look, you know, he even brought up Frank Sinatra and Keith Richards and people like that to me, where he was saying, look, you know, these guys, I can tell you, and they can tell you epic stories of parties where they were up for 12 days and they this, that, and the other and puked and whatever. But they're here, they're still making music, and so you don't really judge them for it in the sense that Charlie feels he's being unfairly judged by everybody, including the executives at 2.5 Men, his TV show, that he's just a party animal, and yes, he's been over the top a few times in the last 6 months, but that's no reason to shut down his TV show. It's no reason to tell everybody that he's a crackhead, that he's a horrible person, he's a horrible father, he's a horrible human being. That's taking it too far, and that's the message he kept trying to get across to me was, I'm not saying that partying is right, but I do what's right for me, and why is everyone just out there trashing me for the excessive partying that I do? It's my life. I feel like I'm okay doing it, and you know what? I'm not really interested in the opinion of everybody, and that's what's really, like I said, hard to argue with him about.
Yeah, doing crack doesn't make you a crackhead. Tell it to the judge, Chaz. But as far
yeah, exactly. Well, I knew, you know, by the way, you know what my favorite question I asked was? I worked on so many Charlie Sheen stories, and you know what my favorite one was?
Which one?
When people kept throwing his Mercedes-Benz over the cliff at his house.
Yeah.
Like, what in the hell was happening when people kept driving cars off the cliff, his Mercedes? Like, it didn't make any sense to me. And the funny thing is, that was the one question where he was like, yeah, I can't talk about it, so I'm going to go investigation. In other words, he didn't want to answer that one. I said, yeah, because I know exactly how parties like that get after 36 hours. Somebody probably thought it was a great idea to floor your car over the cliff. And I said, you probably were one of those people. And he was just like, yeah, can't talk about it, ongoing investigation.
I'm wondering if there's a potential for repurposing that potentially as part of your expanded online strategy.
Well, the first thing is that there's 100 million feet of film in our library. It's the largest sports film library in the world, and the only other human endeavor that has been recorded more extensively on 16-millimeter film than the National Football League is World War II. And eventually we're going to pass them. I think eventually with the internet is that our entire library will be available to fans on the internet. So if you're a Earl Campbell fan and you want to see, I want to see all of Earl Campbell's touchdowns, you'll be able to access our library and just punch up Earl Campbell touchdowns and every one of his touchdown runs will come up. Or if you're a Browns fan and you want to see something with Bernie Kosar or Brian Sipe, all of that, every Brian Sipe touchdown pass will be accessible through the internet. So that's going to be, it's still 3-4, maybe 5 years away, and it's going to come through the NFL.com, but we're at the process now of logging and categorizing that.
What are your thoughts of the critique of financial journalism that we hear from somebody like Jon Stewart, who's really, I think, throwing a lot of stones in a way? It seems to me a sort of, phony populism as far as just, he seems to be indicting everybody in much the same way as far as the coverage of it. I'm sure there was a lot of good coverage.
Well, I have to say this. I was riveted for those couple of days with Jon Stewart because he wasn't wrong, okay? Now, it's very easy to throw stones, of course. The fact is, that I turn to this. First of all, in that first 2 months of Fox Business, we had people on. I'll pull out Peter Schiff of Euro Pacific Capital, who actually I went to high school with him, but he's on a lot of the business networks, and he came on and was this dissenting voice and said the Dow will go below 10,000 in the next 8 months. And you can't tell me that people didn't hear that it wasn't going to happen. They heard it on Fox Business if they watched. That was in our early, early days, and we continue to always provide the alternative of what is out there, because it doesn't help if you just have a chorus of people singing, yeah, me too. That doesn't help anybody. So I actually kind of liked and supported what Jon Stewart did. The one thing that I turned to and explained to people, as far as all that imploded and blew up in people's faces, specifically these very weird derivatives that AIG had, these credit default swaps, which are insurance products, different from insurance, because insurance policies, you actually have to have the collateral behind them in case the hurricane does hit. With credit default swaps, because they didn't call it insurance, they called it swaps, that predicated that they didn't have to have collateral behind it. So when all of these things fell apart after subprime and unwound, there was no pillow at AIG, and that's why we almost went into the toilet. It was a terrible thing. So for me, you had the smartest people in the room at the ratings agencies. These are these companies, Moody's, Fitch, and S&P, Standard & Poor's. These are the people who are paid to know whether something's healthy or it's going to blow up or implode. Even they didn't know. So how could I know? You know what I'm saying? It's not an excuse, but we actually, it's like saying, well, the patient should have been smarter than the neurosurgeon. How can I be smarter than the neurosurgeon? We have learned a lot from this experience, and that is spot the bubbles more quickly. I will say this, that in 2005, I sat on the set at CNBC, a couple of us did, and questioned the real estate situation. I said on the air, listen, I remember the dot-com bubble. This kind of looks like it when you have taxi drivers flipping condos in Boca Raton. Do you know I got hate mail?
Wow.
You're not patriotic. This time, this is something different. This real estate thing, it's never going to go down. This is the greatest thing for Americans, home ownership. Well, you know what? Home ownership is not a right. It's a privilege. Okay?
Yeah.
Hate to break it to everybody. It's a privilege. And if you can't afford it, you shouldn't do it. And we got into trouble there, but people don't want to hear the bad news. They just don't.
No.
Not like we didn't ask when we were at CNBC. We did, but boy, did we ask at Fox. But it was a bubble, and it'll happen, people. Sorry to say, it'll happen again.
It seems to me, almost at the risk of oversimplifying, a mirror image of 4 years ago. The way that Cleveland kind of came up on Miami in the process really seems to mirror the way that Miami came up on Cleveland 4 years ago, and that people really weren't taking seriously the scenario until it happened. It just seems to me that, from the moment that Cleveland won the lottery, that just seemed to set all the balls in motion this time here, and that it ended up in a place I would think nobody could have anticipated going into that night.
I'd say it's a fair comparison, not simply because they won the lottery, but because obviously Miami was caught by surprise in his decision to go back to Cleveland. Most people that are familiar with LeBron always felt that he would go back eventually. It was just a matter of when. But this timing seemed a little bit odd. Now, that's probably a little bit odder in going back now than it was leaving Cleveland and going to Miami. But I believe that some of that surprise was because it wasn't necessarily a decision that LeBron had fully committed to until he actually did it. Now, I know that he made the decision and he told Sports Illustrated. Sports Illustrated was aware of what he was going to do a week before they actually announced it. But coming into the postseason, I don't believe that he already had his mindset that he was going back to Cleveland at this point, just as I don't believe that when he left for Miami. I know that there was a time during the free agent period where he was still talking to Chris Bosh about possibly joining him in Cleveland. And when Bosh said no, that's when he decided, you know what, then I really don't have any choice. If I have to play for a ring and I have to win a ring and that's what I need to validate my superstardom, then I'm going to have to go to Miami to get that done. So I would say that there are a lot of comparisons there, and probably the defining one between the two is the fact that nobody really knew what he was going to do except LeBron, and even LeBron wasn't sure what he was going to do until he got fairly along in the process.
Thoughts on this epic event that really did so much to kind of shape the modern landscape of big-time fights and maybe even other sports as well?
Well, first of all, the good news is I was there at the arena at Madison Square Garden that night.
Mm-hmm.
The bad news is it was 40 years ago and I'm still here.
That's good news, Bert.
but it was not just a fight. It was an event. It transcended just being a fight. It was a morality play in the middle of the Vietnamese conflict. And one man, Ali, stood for the anti-Vietnamese war. The other man, unbeknownst to him, had become the standard bearer, Joe Frazier, for the pro, hard hat approach to the war for it. So that took it to another realm, not just a fight. Albeit the fight matched the buildup, it paid off. But it was an event I don't think that will ever be able to be duplicated again in the history of sports, let alone boxing.
Bert, I'd just like to expand on that for a second. Again, as somebody who was there and as somebody who saw it unfold from the media perspective, it's interesting because, again, everything I've learned about it has been, of course, subsequent to that point in time. But my sense as sort of an amateur sports historian has been exactly what you said, that it really kind of set the template for what was to come. That in this day and age, I mean, there's the Super Bowl every year. There's, if you want to go further afield, WrestleMania, all these other things here. But the fight of the century did a lot to shape this, didn't it?
Yeah, it did in part, but it stood on its own more than anything.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't just the fight. There'd been previous fights of the century, mm-hmm. going back to Johnson and Jeffries in 1910. Mm-hmm. In fact, the best name, Barney Nagler, a writer, called it the fight. He needed no other really rosy terms. It was just the fight. This was big enough. And because we lived in a world that wasn't fractionated like it is now with
tweeters and my faces and other things. Everybody was concentrated on this one fight as an event. It just is something you can't duplicate today. Magazines were in the boss position. Every cover, front cover, had this fight on it. Life magazine, Sports Illustrated. Look, every one of them did. Television, three major networks, every one of them did. So you couldn't get away from it. This was, and today you can get away from anything. Just hide your head in the computer and you're away.
I'm curious, again, for those of us that have never seen the process from the inside, to what extent, as you're speaking with David Chase or somebody else involved like this, any of the other writers, to what extent are you participating in the development of the character and possibly giving your input as to, gee, maybe, do you suppose he might do this in this situation? How does the evolution of a character go?
I would say it's a 50-50 proposition. Mm-hmm. What happens, that they write the material mm-hmm. and you interpret it. But when you bring something that you know is right for the character, they get very excited and they write even more for you because they realize you know the character. By that time, you know the character, and they listen to you, and they hear you, and they hear the voice. And I honestly can say that Uncle Junior was really a highlight because I could bring something of myself into it that made the character interesting, made him three-dimensional, made him real, and made him believable. So that's the job. You make it believable when you can bring something to the character that fits the circumstances of the play. It's really a play. Shakespeare said it. The play's a thing. So without the writers, you don't have it. You can be the greatest actor in the world. If you get lousy material, there's only a certain amount of impact you're going to have. But when you get great writing, like Shakespeare, there are many Shakespeare plays, and you bring your talent to that, then you got the audience in the palm of your hand, and they'll believe everything you say, and they'll react accordingly.
You were able to get a ride for the Indianapolis 500. You were able to make that happen, and with that ride, to win the race, and at the very end there, with that very remarkable climax to the race, to get past J.R. Hildebrand, the man who replaced you in your previous ride, I mean, it almost seems too fantastic to believe, doesn't it?
Well, I mean, the Indianapolis 500 for me was phenomenal. That's certainly a race I'm incredibly passionate about. It's one of those races where you need to be in the right situation to win. And, you know, to join my old friend Brian Herter, my old teammate, was, obviously special for me. We didn't join forces because we were friends. I think we joined, forces because we really felt very confident in one another's ability. And there was a huge amount of trust there. And, for me, he was able to give me a package to win. He collaborated with Sam Schmidt's team. And I got to tell you, right from the get-go, it just, we were very, very competitive.
Dopamine triggering pleasure centers in the brain and everything. And that's the thing that I think really just illuminates the physical tie-in to this with brain chemistry here. I mean, it's the same thing that happens to coke addicts or anybody else like that. It becomes a brain chemistry issue. And even if you're doing pretty good on willpower and everything like that, you have to overcome this need that's sort of been hardwired into your body by experience.
Well, I certainly agree. It's an insidious disease, compulsive gambling. It's ruined a lot of people's lives, millions of lives, and it's probably going to ruin that many more lives or more in the future because of the exposure to gambling. And, you always ask a question, why, and I'm sure there's some physical reasons why. And I believe that they need to set aside some funding so that they can do more research on why compulsive gamblers have the problem and why they relapse so easily and why it's so tough to recover and why the people would go to the extremes like I did to continue to make the bet. So it's a baffling illness. It's an insidious illness, and it's in the infancy stages. I always say that gambling and the acceptance of compulsive gambling is probably 25 years behind what alcoholism or drug abuse is. So it's a very misunderstood disease.
Something that I found fascinating, again, from the DVD was I think it's very clear that you are sincere in what you've said about, you came to terms with Sean, you managed to put the past behind him, that he is a different person now with having found Christ and everything like that. But what I was fascinated by in watching that was your recall on some of the things that happened from back in the 90s. I mean, you're somebody that has had concussion issues, the stroke. Even those of us that have been fortunate enough not to have that happen, I feel like maybe couldn't recall these kinds of things. So I'm fascinated by the thought process on that, Brett. I mean, these are clearly things that you still remember about what happened then, but I guess would it be fair to say you remember, but it just doesn't have the capacity to wound you as it once did?
Well, I remember it all, but I've moved on past it. You know, you have to, you know, I always say this, but it's just the truth, is that when you've suffered a stroke like what I suffered in 2002, you learn over time that the things that you carry around and all the grief and the, like, you know, when I suffered the stroke in 2002, I was still grieving pretty hard over my brother Owen's death, and Bulldog's death just happened a few weeks earlier, and there was a lot of dissension in the family, and there's a lot of strife and going on in my daily sort of routine, and you know, it's the same thing with Sean. Sean bothered me for years, what happened with Sean, and I'll never forget what happened. I'll never forget how I feel. I wanted to express myself and tell everyone how I felt and what exactly happened, at least in my words. And I was able to write my book, and I was able to do that. And I remember I kind of finished and wrote the book, and it was over, and it was done, and I made my point, and most people appreciated my point, and you know, it was kind of like over, except for everyone just sort of had tagged me as a guy that was still not over what happened. And the more I thought about it, I said, you know, the best thing I can do to move on is to really move on and, to kill this thing and put it to rest and, make a truce with Sean. And I tried for quite a long time to, make some kind of connection with Sean where I could at least explore whether it would be worth trying to make any kind of truce with him, and then through different channels, we eventually did get there, but I think it was good for him, it was good for WWE, it was good for me, and above all, it was good for wrestling fans, and I feel today in my everyday sort of routine, I feel a lot less strife, and I'm glad I went back, and anybody that sort of goes, oh, he sold out, and he went back, or he didn't do the right thing, or he should never have gone back, they don't know what they're talking about. I did it for my own peace of mind, And that's the most important. That's all that matters.
As we bring the show to a close, we would like to extend our deepest gratitude to NBC, CBS, ABC, Fox, all Clear Channel affiliates, TNT, TBS, USA, UPN, Deadspin.com, YouTube.com, YTMND.com, MySpace.com, various blogs, Fox News, CNN, CNBC, MSNBC, IamBored.com, Billboard.com, Google.com, ESPN, ESPN2, ESPN News, ESPN Classic, NBA TV, NFL Network, Sports Time Ohio, Athlon Magazine, Comedy Central, Cartoon Network, The Boomerang Channel, QVC, BET, The Spice Channel, Steno Notebooks, Manwich, Papermate Office Supplies, Waitresses, Strippers, Bartenders, Garbage Men, Janitors, Microwave Popcorn, The Writers of The Office, Scrubs, Entourage, My Name is Earl, Oz, Metalocalypse and the Boondocks, Awkwafina, and The Periodic Table of Elements.